Four items on the agenda. I'll start with adding one thing that's not on the agenda. That's just information that's in your material. Regent Ridley asked for some housing information by age, and when I saw that, I said, "Well, you know, that all the board would like to see it. That's good stuff." Anyway, this is a memo dated January 12 from Brian Meredith to me, and at John's request. But that might give you some sense of the age breakdown of our students on and off campus. It's more information than you might seek, but gives you a pretty good demographic profile by age of our students and where they're living, both on and off campus. So it's this memo right here with your material. So thank you, John.
Yep.
Start with at this January meeting, we typically have a couple of year-end reports, particularly with athletics and development that are on the agenda, and we'll have our construction report and a General Assembly preview as we're now well underway with the 2015 Kentucky General Assembly. So we'll start with Todd Stewart and a calendar year-end, or really a mid-year academic year athletic report. Todd?
Thank you, Dr. Ransdell. I know Julia passed out this form to you, which is essentially a one-pager with what I would consider the key highlights of our year. I'll touch on a couple of these. Most of the goals that we have, as we've talked about before, really fall under one of three areas: academic, community involvement, and certainly athletic achievement. And I really feel very good about what we are doing under each of those three. You know, academic is the most important one, as I know you all would agree. We're all here to help our students graduate. And, you know, in the athletic department, we're proud of the fact that in the last calendar year, 101 athletes graduated. Our average GPA of all 378 athletes is a 3.0. And the thing I really would like to point out here, I mean, sometimes I get the comment from a couple people when I talk about our average GPA, there is an incorrect assumption that maybe there are a handful that do superbly, but there are many who don't do well, and that's how you end up with a good GPA, and that's just simply not true. Of the 378 athletes that we have, only 18 of them have a GPA lower than a 2.0. So 95% of our athletes have a GPA above what is required to graduate here. So it's very solid across the board. You see there 12 of our 14 sport programs have a cumulative GPA of a 3.0 or higher. The NCAA requires a 930 APR number to be eligible for postseason play. 17 of our 18 sports actually have an APR of 950 or higher, and the one that doesn't is football, which has a 947. So it's almost there. And of the 14 schools in Conference USA, Rice and Western Kentucky are the only two that has every sport with an APR of 947 or higher. So, you know, feel really, really good about where we are from an academic standpoint. In terms of our community involvement, that's a key thing, too. I mean, we're always asking people to buy tickets and support our programs, and that really has to be a two-way street. Certainly, we need to have an impact in our community, and that involves everybody. I mean, it involves our coaches and our players and our administrative staff, and I feel good about that because the year before I became the athletic director, as best we could tell, and we didn't do a really good job of charting our community involvement, but as best we could tell, we had about 500 hours of community service that we were doing as a group, and we weren't really sure if that was good or bad. I mean, certainly 500 is better than zero, so it wasn't bad, but also felt that really we could do better than that, and we have. I mean, we've gone from 500 in the 2011-12 year to we're over 1,000 hours this year with 5 months to go. So we've more than doubled that and may end up almost tripling it by the time this year is finished. Certainly on the athletic front, I mean, we're in the business of college athletics, and the approach that we've always taken is if we're involved in any event and they keep score, then our goal is to win. I couldn't imagine approaching it any other way. And we've had a lot of success recently. And the thing that I feel good about is I really feel like we are relevant on the national stage, you know, that we really are. I mean, if you look here, we've had four sports defeat ranked teams this year, and we've also had two other ones, volleyball and women's basketball, currently ranked in the top 25 of the 350-plus Division I teams. If you're ranked in the top 25, that's pretty special. We've had two that are ranked in the top 25 four other ones that have won ranked games. In the case of football, it was the first time we've ever beaten a ranked opponent when we won at Marshall. We've also had a lot of success over what is described as the Power Five conference teams. I mean, six of our sports, as you can see there, have beaten teams from the SEC or the Big Ten recently, and certainly that's something that we would hope that we continue to do. Our football program had a really strong year, finished strong, struggled a little bit in the middle of the year, but ultimately set 47 school records, won eight games, which was the most we'd ever won against FBS teams, and then obviously won our first ever bowl game. Made it a little bit interesting at the end, but we did manage to still hang on to the trophy and get home with that. But it was a very good trip, very good experience overall. And the neat thing there is we have 16 starters returning next year. So I think we're poised to have a really good year next year. Volleyball won 30 games, was ranked in the top 25, as I mentioned earlier, and reached the NCAA tournament for the eighth time since Travis Hudson's been our coach. Our soccer program was really young this year. 18 of our 22 players were freshmen or sophomores, but still won 10 games for the 12th time in the last 14 years. Our cross-country programs didn't do as well as they had in the past. They were young, like soccer was. So I'll jump to the end and touch on basketball for a second. Our men and our swimming programs are both ranked, in, as you can see, in the top 35 in the national rankings, so certainly they're relevant. And men and women's basketball, really right now, I mean, knock on wood, we still have two-thirds of the conference season left, but they're having special years. We looked it up. Both are currently 6-0 in the conference, and the last time both were 6-0 in the conference at the same time was never. It's actually never happened before. So we're on a bit of a roll right now, and had a good win. Our men did last night over UTEP, and our women were at UTEP. Conference USA does the scheduling a little bit different than what the Sun Belt did. They call it mirror scheduling. So we always play the same opponent on the same day, but in exactly the opposite venue. So if our men are home with UTEP, our women are at UTEP. Saturday, our men are home with Texas San Antonio. Our women are at Texas San Antonio. So there's no double hitters anymore like we used to have in the past. The one disappointment that I would be very candid with you has been our attendance. It's getting better, but it's certainly not where we would like it. I don't think it's through a lack of publicity. I think people know about our events. It's not through a lack of effort, but I feel like our core teams are performing at a high level, and in most cases are actually deserving of better crowds than what we've had, and hopefully that continues. Hopefully with football next year, and by having, like I said, 16 starters back and finishing the way we did, we can sell out that stadium. It's only 22,000. I mean, there's no reason why we can't sell that out. And men's basketball had a really good crowd last night. There was a lot of energy in the building, but we haven't had enough of those type of games. So hopefully that becomes more normal. And our women's program has probably been the biggest disappointment in terms of attendance. When you look at what they've achieved and the way they represent, you know, we're averaging a little bit over 1,000 a game, and that really needs to change. And hopefully it will. We still have five more home games on the women's side, and they're against teams that people have heard of. So as we win and we play teams that people are more familiar with, hopefully the crowds go up. But overall, I feel really, really good about where we are right now in these three areas. And certainly if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Todd, would you refresh my memory on how the students access the athletic events? Is that part of their package, or just would you...
It is. It's actually part of a student fee that's part of tuition, and all they have to do is show their student ID, and they get in for free. There's no actual purchase of a ticket required.
And attendance of the students versus the general populace, is that up, down, not good? Can you give us a little
That's a good question. I would say, can I choose like one of the options you didn't give me there? I'd say it's not where I think it should be. I mean, last night we had a pretty good student turnout. I don't really subscribe to the excuse that school's out for 6 weeks during the J term, because we have so many students that live in Warren County. I mean, they're still here, you know, so we have to just continue to engage them. They make a difference. They bring energy. But it is somewhat of a nationwide trend, believe it or not, at Louisville. All their students didn't pick up their tickets for the UK game at the Yum Center. So, I mean, when Louisville students aren't using all the tickets they have when they play Kentucky at home, Duke is not using all of their tickets, Wichita State is not. So it's not just a Western Kentucky issue, but obviously Western Kentucky is all we care about. We need more more students in the venue, and we'll continue to be as proactive as we can to try to get them here. We have a couple initiatives that we will start now that school is almost back in session. I'm going to trump Lindsay Boyd in the marketing department by Chuck telling you this. We were going to wait on it, but I think it's relevant to mention it today. We're going to try something with students that for all of our remaining, after tomorrow, for all of our remaining men and women's home basketball games, every student that is actually in their seat before the game begins, we will bring pizza to them. You know, before we had it in the hallway, and actually
sounds like that's so, like a good idea.
So we'll give you free dinner if you just show up before the game. So we'll try that and see if that will help there.
I'm ready to say I'm a sophomore.
Yeah. I might still be a sophomore. I need to check on that.
Well, thank you for that comment, because I do think that incentives is an important thing, and if we need to reach out to the general public and supporters of the university to get the students excited, that should be a part of it as well. So
it helps when they're in the residence halls. I agree with Todd that the January term, most of our students live within 50 miles of campus, but when they're in their beds in their residence halls, 5% of them, within a couple hundred yards of the arena, it does make a difference. So the students are back. I think they showed that last night, and so we'll keep creating incentives. Good.
But the ones that come are terrific, and I know some of you were there last night, and when
really?
UTEP had three free throws with a little over a second to go, that's about as loud as I've ever heard the arena.
I mean,
and that was because of the students. I mean, they really made a difference.
Right. They did an assist on that one missed free throw last night, our students did.
They did, yeah.
Thanks, Todd. All right. Very much.
Thank you.
Brian Russell. Where's Brian? All right, Brian, come on up. Brian Russell is our chief facilities officer, as you know, and we'll give you an update on campus capital projects.
Good morning, and thank you very much. First, I'd like to say that 2014 was a very successful year. We got a tremendous amount of things accomplished. Our Bureau Downing Student Union is completed. It is a beautiful facility, and I know that most everyone in here has been in that facility. We are going through what we call a punch-out phase of that building, as we're going in as we actually occupy and use that facility, but we're getting very close to completion of what I call the details of that project, and we're really proud of it. We did a lot of things on the main campus down the corridor that I thought is really brought a lot of beauty and safety, and coming down the Avenue of Champions, and we accomplished a lot. What we have in front of us today is I'm just doing a highlight of a few projects that are on our campus. This is a visual of the science campus. It's the North Wing. It's a $48 million state-funded project that you all have authorized for us to start design and get going. And with those funds, this is what the building looked like. This is some in-house work. The Planning, Design, and Construction Department worked with our Environmental Health and Safety Group. We are raising the Thompson Complex North Wing. We in-house did the scope of the work. We worked Environmental Health and Safety. We did the surveys. Got the building abated from hazardous materials. Wrote scope of work. We engaged a contractor.
Now go back, Brian. How many of those trees are we going to be able to save?
All of the trees that you see that currently around the building, this is for the demolition phase. So we identified these trees, worked with our contractors, told them you're not allowed to get around those trees to salvage or to save those trees. So those trees that are highlighted are to be saved. There are a few that are going to be adjacent to the building, like there's a couple that are right next that probably will not survive construction. A lot of times people try to save a tree that you're digging the roots out from underneath half of it, and it looks alive, but the following year, typically in a year or two, it will not make it. So sometimes it's better to just go ahead and remove. This was after abatement. A lot of the windows and things have to be taken out by certified contractors, goes to a hazardous type landfill. This is a shot of the actual demolition of the facility. Got started. We were very successful. We had five competitive bids. We had $1 million budget to do the entire project. Our project with abatement, with doing in-house and being frugal with the hazardous abatement and things we've done, we're about $750,000. So we actually have under what we thought it would cost us to take this building down completely. Within this, I wanted to show you just kind of an aerial overview of the facility, and right now we're currently in what we call the programming design with Dr. Stevens and the staff, having discussions with the architects and engineers, discussing the new science building, the programming that's going to go in that building, how the adjacencies are going to be, how the pedestrian walks, how the actual vehicular is going to be in and out of this new facility that we're going to build in this location where the Thompson Complex North Wing. You can see that most of the roofs around this facility, this is our Ogden College in total, have been replaced, relatively new. But you can see the center wing is absolutely full of mechanical equipment. A lot of that has to do with the chemistry type labs and things that are located on the fourth floor. And that roof will get replaced along in a renovation scope of work. So we're doing a lot of work with a lot of people currently to determine what is the best needs for the university. And so we're moving that project forward. What I want to show this is on our normal drive, we have an Honors College International Center. This is a relatively recent rendering that was created. They've done some internal renderings of the building to kind of let you all see what we're going to have completed fall of 2015. Some of the spaces on the second floor, the third floor. That is going to have a balcony that's going to overlook Normal and look straight toward EA Diddle Arena. When they aligned this building, that axis was important to the university and to the master plan. This is the building under construction. This is just typical metal frame construction. We typically, on our campus, for safety reasons, almost 100% of our buildings are all constructed of non-combustible materials, and we feel that that's a very good method and safe method that we employ. This exterior sheathing, there's a lot of work going underneath. This is the rear view. Not many people see the rear view of the project yet, but going to be a nice courtyard, learning center, outdoor spaces adjacent with this building. This is exciting here. This is Carol Martin Gatton Academy. I want to talk about it. It's really Florence Schneider Hall, built in 1929. In the year 2007, we fully renovated a building that had been decommissioned. And there started the Gatton Academy of Mathematics and Science. Since that time, for three consecutive years in a row, it has been rated the number one high school in the United States, and that is an outstanding achievement for the state of Kentucky, for this group. And I can't say how impressed I am that year after year they hold themselves to that type of standard. This is the west view where we're going to do an expansion to that facility. Right now we have 120 students, juniors and seniors, high school students that live in this facility, and we're going to do an expansion that adds 80 more or take up to 200 students per year. What's going to happen is that this is going to be the currently out for bid. February 26th, we're actually going to receive bids on this project. We have received a gift, about $10 million, to add three additions, which are going to be wings to the two end places and then in the center. I think I better represent that on a rendering. We're going to add into the center of the building some administrative, some multi-purpose, some general use space, some gathering spaces for the students. And then this building is also we're going to start construction May of 2015. We're going to have it complete in June of 2016. We'll have our students back in their normal home in August of 2016. We are temporarily going to be this next, when we start construction, the students are actually going to go into Base Runner Hall, which is adjacent to this facility, and so we'll be utilizing a housing residence life facility to temporarily for a year displace those students. We have found through these big renovation projects it's much better to go ahead and move these students, especially these students as young as they are, out of construction and the noise and the harm's way, and we'll be able to complete this project much faster.
Let me just mention that the groundbreaking for that project will be in May, immediately after commencement, the Gatton Academy commencement. And at that same time, there have been multiple gifts to this building, but it's all with private funds, but there have been multiple gifts, and all those will be also announced at the time of that groundbreaking. So a lot of work behind the scenes has gone into making this expansion possible. But all that will be a pretty exciting moment for us in May.
This next Confucius Institute, this is a picture of our visiting scholars' residence located on Normal Street. It's also adjacent by the Honors and International facility. This site had a couple of older buildings on the front, very similar to what was in the very back of the site. And we have actually received a gift. We've been talking about this for quite some time. I think the date on this is back in February of 2014. And we had been talking about potentially a site for the Confucius Institute. We have received a gift. And we would like to propose this be the site for a new Confucius Institute on Western Kentucky University's campus adjacent to our Honors College and International Center.
And we'd end that in the executive committee report.
This is an aerial that was provided just recently of, we call it the Alumni Square. We have the Alumni Center. We have what I would call Greek Row. We have a parking deck, and we have some absolutely outstanding, beautiful apartments that the students are enjoying along Kentucky Street. We have a new 108-room Hyatt Place Hotel being constructed. It's going to be open in April of this year. We have some new development that's being created by Midtown, by Brookside. Those happen to be apartment buildings that are just adjacent.
Go back a minute, Brian. Let me be sure the board kind of knows what's unfolding here. Obviously, the Hyatt Place. This is a development of student housing. We are not involved in that. That's a company called Trentenbach out of Columbia, Missouri, and they've done similar projects at the University of near the University of Missouri. But this U-shaped project here eventually will be replicated on the backside, creating an interior courtyard, and then this will be the parking for it over here. And then this is a restaurant, swimming pool kind of a thing. They bought that corner as well. Will be part of this development. But again, that's all private. We're not involved at all. They're not in our housing portfolio. But it is part of the TIF, and it is helping to clean up this whole area. Obviously, we were part of the at a previous meeting, our adult student apartments here, and that wrapped parking garage here. So this hoe and of course Greek houses going down the street, the Fideout house is under construction here. We're trying to find a way to work with the ATOs on this site right here. So a lot is happening in this broad area north of the campus, almost none of which is university-owned property. This is all part of the downtown development. Ann's on the single-purpose entity 2 board that governs this block, and this is owned by the Student Life Foundation. But huge enhancements for the university and what's going on here. And you, I think, are fully aware that since Dean Katz is not here, this is the site for the proposed Gordon Ford College of Business building that will be our number one priority for the General Assembly when we go forward with the 2016 General Assembly. And then that includes a parking structure in this parking lot right across Kentucky Street over here to displace this parking right here. That would be the site for the proposed College of Business building. So a lot is happening at the north end of the TIF, of which all of this is, and developing that as part of the south end of the downtown development that goes all the way to the medical center. So I just wanted the board to kind of have that context. That's a neat aerial photo that really shows. Some of you remember what this area was when we were in school, and it wasn't not a pleasant part of town. So good development of this end of the downtown area.
This group may know there was an organization. There's an organization, CDFA, known nationally. And Bowling Green's TIF, in fact, was recognized at their national conference for an award using tax incremental financing. And it was quite, Mary Coron represented the Downtown Economic Development Authority at that meeting. And she said it was an incredible honor because of who else was receiving the awards. And for a community our size to be recognized like that was what. She just felt like she was playing with the big guys, you know, that very large organizations. And so it was nice she came back with an award for Bowling Green for the whole TIF district, and complimented President Ransdell and Medical Center at the bottom of the hill for all contributing toward this successful project.
On the housing that's being built private,
yes.
Do you see that in any way negatively affecting the housing that we have in here?
No, I really don't. I think my hunch, it's not anything based on any data, but my speculation would be that it might affect other off-campus residential properties that are geared towards students, some that may have a little age on them. This is going to be... I think they'll sell pretty quickly.
But is predominantly students as well.
Yeah, well, it's all students.
All students.
Well, I guess it's private, so I guess if they wanted, they could lease to somebody that's not a student, but that is not their business plan. But, you know, freshmen and sophomores are required to live in housing. We've got 5,000 beds. We control those beds. It works well within our housing and residence life. And so I don't see this affecting us any more than the registry or Gables or some of the other properties from which our students are able to easily come to campus. In fact, I think it's an asset. I think it just improves the quality of life for our students, but I do not see it having a negative impact on our housing portfolio.
This is
Howard, any
I totally agree. Yep.
Yeah.
You've seen this rendering before, and here we are a couple of days ago, just a clear shot of the Hyatt Place, which is, they say they're going to be open and ready for business in April of this year. So looking forward to that addition to our, adjacent to our campus, and I think it'll be very beneficial for a lot of events and people and convenience. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian, very much. Catherine? year-end calendar year-end development report.
I'll try to be brief. We report to the IRS our fundraising goals on a fiscal year basis. Because we've gotten engaged in the media, and thank those of you who are supporting me, which I think is all of you, this is just a year-end snapshot. It's relevant for several reasons, I think, and I'll quickly tell you what I think the important things are. First, this calendar year is the best calendar year we've had in 5 years. Now, again, at the end of the fiscal year, we'll report to the IRS, but it's a very encouraging thing because of the number of years we're out of a campaign, to see the totals sustaining and getting a little bit higher is really important. In general, we are getting great support from the people on the major gift level and huge support in planned giving. And now we're beginning to see larger annual giving programs, and many of you probably received mailings this year that were different. We had some thank you mailings to donors. We had some specific Giving USA Day efforts and so forth. And we're now beginning to use the internet more, the web more, to get people engaged. And the younger alums are really responding to this. So it's a very positive report. We'd love it to be even stronger next year, and that's our plan, because if we can keep this kind of base, then the university is well prepared at some point in the future. Knowing our president, he'll want to have another campaign before his tenure is over, and there will be priorities and reasons to do that. So this is just a snapshot. I'll be glad to answer questions if I can. And it's only through December, it's actually through November 30th in terms of the combined endowment. So there's still money coming in beyond this date, but it is a year-end closing number, calendar year-end. Any questions? And I might note two things. The Honors College and International Building could be named for a $5 million gift, and that gift would go into an endowment because the building is paid for. It's the best kind of fundraising, where the building is secured. The money doesn't go into a dark hole. It goes into endowment and lives forever. So as you saw that beautiful building, think about it. And the other thing that the president didn't mention, but it's relevant because I think it will add to the TIF district, the foundation, WKU Foundation, now has had transferred from SPE2 that wrap that we've talked about around the parking garage and so forth, the hope for which has always been, and we'll be pursuing that with an LLC that has been established by the foundation. The people on that LLC are Craig Browning, David Wiseman, Randy Shoemaker, Jack Scheidler, Jim Martins, and me. And that group will be responsible as a private entity for developing the wrap, in hoping to bring a restaurant and other types of facilities there that will benefit the hotel, benefit our alumni and visitors, and enrich that area for everybody. So all of the development you saw will be part of the marketing pitch for why that's a good location for such things. So we'll be closing soon, I think, on the transfer of the deed, and then we're ready to go with Jim Martins leading the charge on a national blitz using the web to get people to see what the opportunity is and ask them to give us their best proposal. And we'll get a lot, we think, from people who already are engaged with the university, but we're going to make it competitive enough to try to have the best mix and opportunity for that area to be successful, both for the foundation's financial well-being, since they're having to invest in it, but I also think it's good for the university because it means it's a home-owned, family-related ownership of that, as opposed to the ownership being someone who's not related to the university.
What Catherine's describing, in case you don't have the mental image of it, that where there's some steel work on the front corner of that parking structure just next to the Alumni Center, facing the campus. That front corner edge of the parking garage is about 6,000 or 7,000?
7,000 square feet. It comes around the corner to the hotel.
So, again, calling on our foundation to do lots of things that we wouldn't really be in a position to do as a university. And so they're hard at it and look forward to seeing. And then that presumably a restaurant, but there may be some other retail options, but
two.
Presumably a restaurant is important with the hotel
right.
opening, because the hotel will have breakfast and cocktail hour kind of a provision, but it will not be a restaurant in the High Place Hotel.
Right.
And there's a lot of student density going into the north end of the campus with what we just talked about, so that's actually is a prime location for development.
Well, I think also we're beginning to see alumni use the Alumni Center as a place for staging when they're coming to campus for events. So I think there'll be a steady flow of people for businesses there. And we're excited about it. We have excellent people on the board to deal with it, so we couldn't be in better hands. Any other questions?
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Robin, come on up. General Assembly is underway.
Well, we're recessed for the moment.
Well, okay.
Before I mention the General Assembly, I'd point out that we passed this out to you earlier, so it should be at your space there. And one of the things that we've really worked hard at, and I really appreciate President Ransdell's commitment to this as well, is the recruitment of transfer students from our KCTCS institutions. That is certainly a high priority for legislators, the General Assembly. And so this is a little piece we did on a fall swing through that President Ransdell made to each of our sister partner institutions on our joint admission agreements. And that's a piece I intend to send to the legislature. It's hot off the press, and thought you all would like to see it.
And while we don't have an enrollment report on the agenda, just know that the spring enrollment numbers show an increase of about 150, pushing a couple hundred growth in transfer students. And we're the largest transfer destination among all the universities in Kentucky, and we're growing that number. And these efforts in the early fall to visit all of the KCTCS campuses where we have joint admissions agreements, of which there are seven in Kentucky, the fruits from those efforts are beginning to pay off with really growing our transfer numbers. So
I think we did some. I think we had some. Yeah, it is the first you've seen it. I think they had some follow-up legislation on transfer in 2008. Dr. Birch was very engaged with us in that legislation, and is that right, 2008? And then that they continue to press for for us to be really heavily engaged with KCTCS and ensuring a transfer path. This is a great way to do it. It's seamless. We have presence on these KCTCS campuses advising those students. We do a number of events on this campus with KCTCS students and at our regional campuses. It's also a pipeline of students for our regional campuses who are located, co-located with KCTCS institutions in Elizabethtown, Owensboro, and also Glasgow. So anyway, this is a great partnership. As I said, we really appreciate the President's commitment to that, and I think the legislature will be pleased to see it as well. This is the short session of the General Assembly. Those, I think you all follow it fairly closely. You know, last year was the 60-day session. This is the 30-day session. They begin in January, the first week, the first 5 days for the House is what has generally always been a leadership organizational first 5 days, and new training for new members and that sort of thing. The Senate got quickly right to work on a number of things the first week. The House spent the first week doing leadership elections in their organization like they normally do. And I've given you all an update on that, but just to reiterate that for you again, we had some very positive outcomes for South Central Kentucky in the leadership elections in the House. Jody Richards, who was, as you all know, is a very good friend to WKU, but was the longest serving speaker in Kentucky history, is now the Speaker Pro Tem. So he took the number two position as Larry Clark, who's from Jefferson County area, stepped down. And Jody won that race. Johnny Bell of Glasgow was elected to the position of majority whip. He defeated Tommy Thompson of Owensboro, who's also been a good friend to us, but certainly we're excited for Johnny and looking forward to working with him. And Johnny is a WKU graduate, actually a WKU Glasgow graduate, and always very helpful to us. And on the Republican side, Bowling Green Representative Jim DeCesare was elected as the minority whip. So that's quite a lot of presence for South Central Kentucky in House leadership. Senate leadership, we had also David Givens, who is a WKU graduate. He lives in Greensburg. David's been a very, very helpful friend to WKU and to higher ed. He serves on the Education Committee. He's been on the Appropriations Committee as well. And David was elected president pro tem, a position that Senator Katie Stein did not seek re-election to the Senate, and so that position was open. And then a name we know somewhat well, Jimmy Higdon, who is a cousin to Freddie Higdon, our regent. Jimmy is from Springfield. He was elected caucus chair in the Senate. And then all the Democrat leadership positions are new in the Senate as well. None of those are individuals from this area of Kentucky. Senator Ray Jones, who is from Pikeville, was elected floor leader. Gerald Neal from Louisville, caucus chair. And Julian Carroll from Frankfort, minority whip. So, interesting. We'll have all new leadership on the Senate Democrat side. Again, very positive for us, and we are looking forward to working with the members of all the members of leadership, but particularly happy to have those from Bowling Green and the surrounding area. As I mentioned, the Senate used their first week in January to push through a number of their priorities. Four of their top five have already passed. Right to work, regulatory reform was a constitutional amendment, informed consent, which is for women seeking an abortion, and then the heroin bill. They've passed all those out, and those will be in the House when they return the first week of February. So we've got one more week. And the House has pretty much said that they'll take up the heroin bill. I think the others are somewhat less likely. The House's priorities, minimum wage, that was a priority left over from last year and prior years. Local option sales tax, which is an initiative that's really, they call it LIFT, the LIFT initiative. A number of communities across Kentucky are supporting that. I think the League Cities. But the Jefferson County mayor is really the champion for that. And actually, Mike Buchanan from Warren County is also pushing for local option sales tax. So that issue is going to come through the House this time, I guess. And then I don't know where this will go, but the House Speaker has signaled a big priority for him is KTRS reform, which has a lot of financial implications. Those could be, certainly have a lot of impact on us given that we are participants in KTRS, so we're monitoring that closely. I just don't have any idea how that will go, but it'll be a priority. And eventually, when they did pension reform, they didn't deal with KTRS, so that's the Kentucky Teacher Retirement System. The governor's pushing for P3 legislation, that's the Public-Private Partnership Bill. That bill actually passed and got to his desk last session, but he vetoed it. It had a provision in there that was kind of an add-on that had to do with, I believe, the bridges in northern Kentucky. And so something that he didn't feel like was relevant to the bill's, to the substance of the bill. I'm not debating that. Don't really know a lot about that, but the bill has a lot of support. We think that passage of that legislation would have an impact on post-secondary institutions in that it would allow, some more, I guess, a little bit of an easier path to working with outside private sector partners on capital projects. The bill really is about allowing government entities to work with private partners to build out capital projects and infrastructure. So I don't know that it has that we WKU would see, some grand new opportunity out of that bill, but it certainly eases the path and we would be for it. We're tracking about 70 bills so far. There are at least three tuition waiver bills that I think are of some concern to us. Any tuition waiver bill is of concern. These are somewhat particular concern. Barbara, one of them would allow adjunct faculty to take up to 6 hours at any public institution. And currently, an employee of any institution of post-secondary education can take up to 6 hours at any other public institution, tuition free. That's very costly, but when you add in adjunct faculty who are not full-time faculty or full-time employees, we're talking big bucks. So we're very concerned about that one. And then a couple of other ones are there that we've dealt with before. So we'll be talking a lot about tuition waivers in this session, as they're mandated, they're unfunded mandates, and they cost us a lot of money. We know of, I guess, Anne, I haven't looked at the numbers for this year, but it's about an $18 million total cost to higher education, and I think that adds up to about $4 million for WKU in a given year, and it grows. So anyway, tuition waivers are a big concern. They're always, always for people who are great groups of people to support, but somebody's got to pay for it, and typically that's us. And so it's a little bit of a problem, obviously. So we're going to be working on those.
Robin.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you take a question?
I can.
I may not even ask this in a way that's legal, but we'll figure it out.
If it's not, I won't answer it. how about that?
You know, the business of the unfunded mandates, and there is no question, the support for faculty, wherever they came from, or staff, sure, or adjuncts. I mean, if you can find ways to enroll them, whichever institution, it is a good thing to do. I mean, there's so many good things to do.
Which is why these are very difficult to
see. And I guess the question I have, and forgive me if I'm explaining this wrong, but my understanding is that if it's an unfunded mandate, that we literally have to show it and set aside funds as though we're receiving the money for it. Or we have to report it in a way that...
Yeah, I am.
Our budget based.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm going...
You know, some people call it a waiver, and you think about you're discounting your price. No, our price is our price. And so when a mandated waiver shows up, and we award what looks like a scholarship to them, and when we report our tuition revenue to the board, it's not cash. It's a recognition in the accounting system. Some of it's cash. Some of it is, in fact, ourselves paying ourselves. So, yeah, we do.
Yeah,
Barbara, I guess my question is this. Given the legislature's not likely to give us the money for these unfunded mandates, is there anything politically feasible in pursuing being allowed to report it differently so that at least
I think those are accounting standards. That's a very different issue.
We do report to the Council on Postsecondary Education annually on how much it costs. So whenever we have the opportunity, we do kindly remind elected officials that this contributes to our underfunding.
But what a different reporting allowance.
We do have to recognize it. It's the same thing with our own employees. We have a fringe benefit that allows our employees and to enroll in our classes. We recognize it as an expense.
Yeah, those are accounting standards.
Our point is to make sure that we continually get that out front, that who's receiving these benefits. It's everything from foster children to university employees to firefighters. And again, as you point out, we're not anti any of these groups. It's just that there is a cost of the education, and we're not getting any real revenue for it.
We're working on it, and we'll track, and we talk. We generally go to the sponsor of the legislation, and last session we were able to work with the sponsors to get them to not proceed, given that they're unfunded, and they understand where we are financially. But they're great. You know, they're hard to, if they get that far, they're hard to speak against, because they're all worthy. And they're all worthy causes.
We have to spend that could be spent on other things that might be more important to us and to our faculty and staff, and it's foregone revenue that so we kind of get hit both ways. We don't get the revenue.
But Barbara, you just
spend the money on.
And you just illustrated the point, though, is because then adding one person to your classroom is not, you know, you're just going to add one person to your classroom. It doesn't mean you have to do anything. It doesn't cost you anymore to add one person to your classroom, but.
That's not really true.
I know it's a real cost. I was just hoping we didn't have to report it. We really got paid to do it.
Sorry. Wish it was that good. And then the other thing that I guess I would mention to you, President Ransdell mentioned that he's going to have Bob King come talk about the funding model. The legislature, particularly some members of the Senate and some folks in the House who are particularly engaged in higher education funding, are expressing some interest in actually talking more about the funding model in this session leading up to the actual budget request next session. So we may or may not have an opportunity to have some hearing in both the House and the Senate that kind of addresses where we are on the funding model. But I can tell you that my conversations with legislators have all kind of circled around to them asking questions about the funding model and having some opinions to weigh in on where we are on the funding model. So I do kind of expect, in an unusual twist, to have that discussion come up in the legislature in a more formal way in the session leading up to the budget session. And then for Regent Ridley, I would mention, we're really pleased to have a lot of interest from the council members, the Council on Post-Secondary Education members, in how can they help us with selling the funding model and being engaged in the legislative process. And I'm going to have an opportunity to meet with Carolyn Ridley on Monday with my colleague from U of L and two of our colleagues from CPE to discuss maybe some strategies and some ways that they could help us and we could help them. So that's a very, very good collaboration. We will host our Teacher Hall of Fame event, which we do annually.
You'll hear more about it when Bob King comes in the spring. But as the funding model unfolds, we're going to be a team player and be supportive, but we want as much of that model devoted to performance as we possibly can achieve. The more of the funding model that's devoted to performance, the more it helps us because of our degree productivity and our credit hour production and our graduation numbers and our STEM graduates and our underserved student success and et cetera, all the measures that go into performance funding we do well with. And so we're pushing as best we can to have as much of, and right now the funding model is only focused on new money. It's not a redistribution of the current base. We prefer that it be a redistribution of the current base, but we're not going to get a model approved. We're not going to win that one. But it will be focused on new money. But we'd like to have all of the new money distributed based on performance. I don't know whether that will be achieved. It's probably going to be about half of it, would be my guess at this point. But those are the things we're sorting through right now that will be defined in the next 30 days or so.
Well, I expect that's part of why the legislature wants to engage in the discussion, because performance is what they're also interested in.
Good.
So we'll host our Teacher Hall of Fame event on March the 3rd, and we are going to do a recognition of the football team, the bowl championship on February 19th. And we won't take the whole football team, but we will take a pretty good group up there, and Coach Brom is going to go as well. And that was something that that our local legislative folks indicated they would like to do. They are the ones who invited us. So anyway, kind of excited about that. And it'll go by quick. These won't be the only issues. In fact, generally, I don't predict anything because you never know. But we'll be prepared for whatever surprises pop up along the way. Any questions?
In the name of surprises that I hope we don't get, so far so good on the state budget. Revenues are up in November, 13% in November. I haven't gotten a December report yet, so I don't know.
I think I sent it to
Ann.
I don't think I sent it to you. I'm sorry.
Slightly down in December, but the 6 month report says that growth was about 3.5% for 6 months, and the budget's built on 3.6. So big numbers like that, a tenth of a percent can matter, but I think that it sounds manageable within state government, but we'll continue obviously getting monthly reports.
I mean, the point of that is we're now only 5 months left in the fiscal year, and I hope we don't get word of a budget cut to end the year to balance the state budget if revenues fall short of projected budget. I'm cautiously optimistic that that will be the case, but I you know, it would be a serious matter for us to deal with the state budget cut going into the second year of the biennium when we know there'll be no state funding. We just want to avoid another cut in the second year of the biennium and try to set a better stage for the 2016 budget session of the General Assembly. So we'll keep you posted as the spring unfolds. There have been times when we've received notice of a mid-year budget cut, the biggest one in 2008 at the start of the recession when we were hit hard at mid-year. So that did not occur at the end of the calendar year, and we'll track it as the spring unfolds.
Thoughts, questions, comments, advice? All right, thanks.
Thank you, Robin. We'll take a 10-minute break and reconvene with the Executive Committee report.